content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled, We Reached the Glacier Just as It Collapsed. The world's widest glacier is melting and changing predictions about our planet's future. This was written by Elizabeth Rush. Out on the bow of the RV Nathaniel B. Palmer, the air is dense and almost warm. We have punched through miles of Antarctic ice floes to reach the Edmondson Sea's foggy interior. I want to honor the remaining distance between us and Thwaites Glacier's calving front. This place that many scientists suggest could make a catastrophic impact on global sea levels, but that no one, as of this moment in February of 2019, had ever before visited by ship. And yet I don't really know what to do except stand here. Just off the port side, a half-flipped iceberg in the shape of a pyramid. It looks like a ruin, something time has partially undone. What rested below the waterline waxed away by the heat of the sea, the once sunk ice smooth as glass. That night, sound asleep eludes me. I wake often, each time hopeful that we have arrived. Finally, around 5 o'clock, I rise. Shuffle up the 5 flights of stairs that separate my cabin from the bridge. Outside, Thwaites' gray margin wobbles in the half-light. We wind alongside it, entering small coves and rounding odd promontories. Our pace is slow to hold this precarious line. The ice face is soft as dunes. The night's new hint of darkness gives way to the bruised light of dawn, and many other people appear to watch what each of the 56 scientists and crew members aboard have been working toward for weeks, for years, and in some cases for more than a decade, come into sharp focus. We don't talk. Instead, we whisper as though in the presence of some otherworldly being. Finally, we gaze upon the edge of Thwaites, which until months ago was unreachable by ship. For the first time since humans started keeping track, and likely in thousands of years, the sea has thawed enough for a ship to sail right up to the glacier's ice front. Rick Wiemken, the chief mate, stands attentive at the Palmer's helm, the captain next to him, steering us along the edges of Thwaites, unfathomable fracturing, its hemorrhaging heart of milk. If Antarctica is going to dump a lot of ice into the ocean this century, it will likely come from Thwaites. That's because the glacier rests below sea level, exposing its underside to warm water incursions that are causing rapid melting from beneath. Satellite imagery suggests that it loses 50 billion tons of ice a year, or the equivalent of the Great Pyramid of Khufu, some 8,000 times over. Put in other terms, Thwaites alone contains more than 2 feet of potential sea level rise, and were it to wholly disintegrate, it would destabilize much of the West Antarctic ice sheet, causing global sea levels to jump 10 feet or more. 10 feet would devastate big chunks of New York and Jakarta, Mumbai and Boston, and heaps of smaller, equally important places. But the more we learn about Thwaites, the more profoundly we understand that many of our predictions about the speed of sea level rise are extremely tenuous. As the first people to ever survey the calving edge of the world's widest glacier, our mission is to bring back as much preliminary information as possible. After our return, these data will be used to begin to refine our climate change models and to strategize the remaining years of the International Thwaites Glacier Collaboration, ITGC. For instance, it will inform a pair of studies published in Nature that suggests that while the underside of Thwaites is melting less quickly than previously suspected, deep and rapidly expanding cracks in the ice could trigger the shelf's collapse. Put another way, At the cold nadir of the planet, Thwaites continues to step outside of the script we imagined for it, defying even our most detailed projections of what is to come. Nearly everyone on board spends that first day up on the bridge in the shadow of Thwaites. We stand together in the difficulty of it, trying to see what sits right in front of us. A slab cantilevers out over the water, like a scalloped shell of a giant clam, studded with icicles formed during the recent warm days. I set up my camera to take a series of time-lapse photos. The shutter opens and closes, opens and closes. The art critic John Berger's famous phrase, "Seeing comes before words," rises to the surface of my thoughts. To see is also to be seen, he argues, to imagine yourself in the eyes of the other. How do we appear from the glacier's perspective? The morning we cruise past is, in glacial time, nothing more than a blip. Inside, the mates track the Palmer's progress on a paper map. According to their faint pencil marks, we are currently on top of the Thwaites Glacier Tongue. Back in 1991, when the chart was printed, this area was frozen solid, a part of the eastern ice shelf that extended miles farther out into the Edmondson Sea. Rick calls me over to the navigational console to look at the Palmer's electronic course plotting system. In the image on the screen, water appears blue, the ice shelf gray, and the place where we sail white and unnamed, unvisited. Rob Larder, the chief scientist, is busy watching the monitor that displays the depths of the seafloor in real time. It's over 1,000 meters deep, he says, deeper than the gravity inversion models predicted. Just like that, on our very first morning, we make a discovery that more water is likely working its way under the glacier than we thought. I sprint to the galley, scarf down 2 hard-boiled eggs and a half of a cinnamon bun, then run back up, taking the stairs 2 at a time. Soon I am outside again, looking away as little as possible. Thwaites calving edge stretches just under 100 miles, so it takes us hours to travel its length. Sometimes the margin appears steep and sturdy and sheer. In other places it loses its sheen, seems chalky and distressed. We turn a corner and the face rockets up into a wall. A wild line twists along the top of the shelf, tracing gorges into blue-white snow. Then, just as abruptly, the parapet has crumbled, cluttering the water with floating pieces of brash ice. A switch flips when we arrive at Thwaites. There is no more of the keeping busy that saw us through the beginning of our journey. No more sauna club or bridge lessons. No more ping pong down in the hold or king cake at midnight. All that matters is the data. Mud samples, seafloor depths, temperature readings, and wave action. We even keep a real-time log of sea ice observations. Hypothetically, each of the different teams slices their days in two. Some people work from noon to midnight and others from midnight to noon. But most rest only when skating dangerously close to delirium. We labor nonstop for nearly a week. Then something shifts again. Down in the dry lab, Rob hunches over his silver laptop. He's got 2 windows open and is clicking back and forth between them. Both contain aerial images of the studied area, the first satellite information to have made its way on board in well over a week. In one, Thwaites' western front is a sturdy rampart. In the other, it looks as if someone took a baseball bat to a windshield. Rob toggles between the two. Cohesive shelf, exploded lodestar, a navigable bay, then the same inlet cluttered with a surreal confetti of bergs. The morning we arrived, we cruised right along the edge of the shelf, I say, looking at the first image. It was pretty smooth, a solid wall of ice. There was some rumpling and slumping, but over the last few days, there appears to have been a real significant release of bergs directly south of us from Thwaites' ice front, Rob says, finishing my thought. Bewildered, he touches his dry palms to his muddy pants. In my stomach, a strange flutter, half fear, half excitement. This is also why we are here, to witness the dissembling that we previously only imagined with words, with calculations born from remote satellite images, and with mathematical models. That dissembling, it appears, is unfolding right in front of us. It looks nearly as dramatic as the Larsen B collapse, Rob says. I reported his reaction in National Geographic at the time. He is referring to one of the largest recorded examples of ice shelf collapse in human history. In 2002, scientists monitored the peninsula through aerial satellite imagery, watched in both amazement and horror as much of the Larsen B ice shelf, a chunk about the size of Rhode Island, fell apart over a period of less than 2 months. In the years after the collapse, ice made its way into the bay as much as 8 times faster than before, proving that when a shelf disintegrates, the glaciers that held it in check can dump far more of their mass into the ocean. Which means in the days and years following this collapse, the flow of thwaites might also accelerate. Data from our mission suggests that sometime over the past couple of centuries, thwaites retreated 2 to 3 times faster than what we see today, signaling that more significant ice loss is possible. 4.5 years later, there is still not a comprehensive study of the ice loss rates in the years following this breakup. The folds of Rob's faded jumpsuit appear bleached in the lab's fluorescent light. The gray pouches beneath his bright blue eyes sag. He clicks from one image to the next again and makes an involuntary sound between a sigh and a grunt. Have you ever been on a ship where something this dramatic has happened in the area where you are working? I finally ask. It is, after all, Rob's 20th time in Antarctica. I haven't, no, he says quietly. All of the remaining work in this unnamed bay is canceled. The less than a week we spent working along this western portion of Thwaites, that is the only time we will have, and now it is over. Up on the bridge, a second mate listens to speed metal while steering us away from the minefield of the collapse. Eventually, I step outside and turn in a full circle, but rarely catch sight of the horizon line. So full is the sea with recently calved bergs. I have wanted to see a glacier calve for nearly a decade. In my mind, the ice would creak and groan, the ship's deck would tremble, clouds of dust would rise up into the bright blue vault of the sky. Walls of water surge toward us. Bearing witness to such a collapse, how could something not shift? But this is nothing like what I expected. No cleaving faces, no echoes of rapture. I turn the circle again. To my right, an iceberg, bigger than the college campus where I teach. Behind it, another and another. Some have soft, white snouts, and others are glossy, their edges shining sharply in the sun. When a glacier steps back or surges in the Arctic, those who live with the ice say it is sending a message. For as long as I have known Thwaites' name, I imagined receiving that message, that this moment in its breaking would ring through my body as warning. But I never considered the possibility that the cracks would be so large I wouldn't know they were cracks, that I wouldn't be able to distinguish berg from shelf, something whole from something broken. I search my memory for signs of collapse, for something, anything dramatic. Just this morning, I asked one of the researchers on board about the bergs, and yes, she confirmed that they come from Thwaites. If we had arrived a day ago, I think, we would believe that this was the way it was supposed to be. This article was adapted from Elizabeth Rush's forthcoming book, The Quickening, Creation and Community at the Ends of the Earth. Next, An Ode to Pull-Ups by James Parker. This is from the December 2022 print issue. Who do I think I am dangling off this bar? I think I'm an ape. I think I'm an aerialist. I think I'm Jason Momoa. I think I'm a 54-year-old man with a dodgy shoulder, experiencing, to the pound, to the ounce, the precise terms of my contract with gravity. That's one thing you can always say for the pull-up. You're lifting your own weight. Its first cousin is, of course, the push-up. But the push-up has no verticality. A blur of ground or of floor bounces madly back and forth in front of your face. And besides, your feet are taking some of the load. So far as body weight goes, that means you're bearing, just Google this, only 64%. No, for the true self-haul, the full load of who you are, it has to be the pull-up. You do pull-ups alone, very alone, but maybe a couple of your pull-up brothers are there too, grimly contemplative, walking in loose circles around the bar, shrugging and sighing. Pull-up talk is minimal and poetic. The other day I asked a big dude if I could jump in between his sets. He took out one earbud as I repeated the question. "Get at it," he said. "Get some." Are you wondering how many I can do? I can do 8. I can do 60. I can do 102 in 13 sets over a period of 2.5 days. Sets of 9. Sets of 4. Sets of naught. As for technique, I've invented my own grip. I call it the French press. The point is, I do them. I do pull-ups, and they never get any easier. Still the same flutter of dismay as I stare up at the metal bar. Still the same sensation of wretched brain cells as I jump and grab and heave. But the pull-up cures me like no other exercise. It lifts me clear of my stews and stagnancies. It dramatizes my rising above. Need a mood shifter, a circuit breaker? Do pull-ups, and do them outside. Nothing against gyms or the pull-up bar installed over a doorway at home. But for the real pull-up effect, you want to be hoisting yourself into the sky. At the moment of maximum effort, you want to be silhouetted against infinity. Then you drop to the earth, the sturdy and ever-supportive earth. There it is, and there you are, ready. From the books section, What Do You Do When You Realize You're Ruining the Earth? By Amy Weiss-Meyer. Thinking ecologically about global warming requires a kind of mental upgrade, Timothy Morton, the environmental philosopher, has written, to cope with something that is so big and so powerful that until now we had no real word for it. In 2008, Morton tried to invent one. Hyper-object. The term doesn't necessarily connote a value judgment that this enormous thing is good or bad, but simply that in its hugeness it is inescapable, like air. To wrap one's mind around the idea of a hyper-object is to accept that we, humans, can't jump out of the universe. And according to Morton, being able to acknowledge the scale of a phenomenon is as awe-encompassing, say, as climate change. To name it might be the first step toward actually doing something about it. Hyper-objects abound in our globalized world. The internet, fast fashion, microplastics, things that cannot easily be measured using a single metric. A character in Lyta Kiesling's new novel, Mobility, tries to explain the concept and lands on this. It's something so big and sticky with so many parts that it can't be seen. Something that touches so many other things. Something another character offers, like the oil industry. It's 2014, and Bunny Glenn, Kiesling's protagonist, is building a career in that very industry, though not without some moral squeamishness. For her, the hyper-object is personal. She feels compelled to defend her involvement in a system that she knows is a major driver of climate change. I work for the non-oil part of it, the part that is moving away from oil, she rushes to clarify, stretching the truth. Some readers might reflexively judge Bunny for her complicity. Surely her choice of to drive a Prius to work can't offset the impact of her company's decades of fossil fuel exploration, what's referred to as upstream in oil industry parlance. And what about the downstream, a category Bunny knows that includes plastics and face lotion and basically everything you might ever want to buy in a supermarket or Target or Neiman Marcus or Walmart, everything they would stick in your arm in a hospital or use to listen to your heart. Plenty of well-meaning people insist, like Bunny, that they're trying to move away from oil. Virtually no one in the developed world, Kiesling reminds us, is not complicit in some way. Perhaps the line between culpability and innocence, this novel suggests, is blurrier than the average liberal reader might like to imagine. That liberal reader might in fact be Kiesling's target audience. This book is the first to be released under an imprint created by Crooked Media, the wildly popular Trump-era resistance podcast franchise. The publisher Zando also has an Atlantic line of books. A tagline on the new imprint's website, reading, it's just not just for tweets anymore, doesn't inspire much confidence. You'd be forgiven for wondering if mobility is more political screed than art. Kiesling, however, has pulled off a rare feat, a deeply serious, deeply political novel that is, quite often, fun to read. It's a coming-of-age story full of delicious detail. Keen satire and a complex humanity, it's informative without being didactic, thoughtfully confronting subjects such as climate change and American imperialism and gender inequality and white flight without taking itself too seriously. Kiesling is not in the business of preaching to the already converted. She's here to hold up a mirror to her readers and to make anyone who cracks this book open squirm a little. Perhaps the novel is as good a tool as any for helping us think about the ways a hyper-object, such as the oil industry, touches our lives and what we do or don't do about it. We first encounter Bunny as a bored American teenager in Baku, the oil-rich capital of Azerbaijan, where her father works for the U.S. Embassy as a public information officer, selling the idea of America. It's the summer of 1998, and Bunny passes long, hot, lonely days fantasizing about boys, watching soap operas with the family's kindly upstairs neighbor, reading and rereading a handful of English language magazines and books. Her British cosmopolitan is dog-eared to note the women Bunny one day hoped to resemble and the products she one day hoped to buy. Yet she's generally uncurious about what happened around her just then, keeping the world of grown-ups and the world of work, in her case, the world of the embassy, at arm's length. She knows enough, but not too much, and prefers it that way. There had been a war between Armenia and Azerbaijan, Bunny knew, Kiesling tells us. It was sort of ongoing, she thought, and she tended not to listen when it was spoken of. Bunny's also aware in a hazy way that oil was the big thing about where they lived now. Introducing Bunny as an angsty teenager is an inspired move. The moody, self-centered fog of adolescence is, after all, a fitting proxy for the state of willful semi-ignorance that can become the default when contemplating the climate crisis. A majority of Americans see the warming world as a threat, but it's tempting to throw up one's hands and wonder, what can be done, really? Can't the grown-ups solve the problem? It's comforting, even in adulthood, to cling to innocence, to continue to make reckless choices, and believe, on some level, that the fairy tales of glossy magazines might prove real. Most of us grow up eventually, though, or at least we like to think so. We do. In Bunny, Kiesling has drawn a character who seems stuck in that teenagerdom, even as she ages. The novel follows her into the 21st century as she stumbles into young adulthood, desperate for a job, any job. At the depths of the recession in 2009, Bunny applies to a temp agency called Manpower and winds up in the all-female administrative pool of a hydrogeological engineering firm. Before she's become the Gal Friday for one of the company's owners, who takes Bunny with him when he leaves off to start a new technology-focused wing of his father-in-law's oil business. At first, most of us would probably be oil and gas tech drilling, he tells Bunny, promising that, over time, it would invest in other kinds of technology, renewables, batteries, clean energy. Thus begins her career in the oil industry. Bunny can't help but be attractive to oil's vaguely glamorous aura. In her childhood in booming Baku, oil was sexy, exciting. Now, in Houston, it's wealth and power and a means to affording the life she envisions for herself. Somehow, the moving away from the oil part of the deal always remains just out of reach. Tellingly still going by her childhood nickname in her 30s, Bunny admires specialized knowledge and expertise, but doesn't always feel herself capable of possessing it. Or maybe she just can't be bothered. She reads books to learn more about the industry and takes a course called Managing the Firm in the Global Economy, but she still finds it very confusing. She's not dumb exactly, just more comfortable dwelling on the surface of things. What Bunny can do, she eventually decides, is devote herself to the woman in energy stuff that's emerging in the 2010s, corporate America's lean-in era. This stuff is ripe for parody, and some of the novel's most enjoyable and illuminating provocations emerge when Kiesling sends Bunny to talks with names such as Storytelling Oil and Gas, where speakers celebrate diversity and promote networking opportunities to bring together the amazing women of this industry, the women literally powering our world. Bunny tells herself that this is progress. Bunny's father, for his part, resigns from a decade-long foreign service career. Kiesling's own father, John Brady Kiesling, is a former diplomat who resigned his post in the lead-up to the Iraq War. The protagonist of her first novel, The Golden State, is also a diplomat's daughter. But instead of quitting oil and gas, Bunny, like the industry itself, which insists on being called energy now, rebrands. She finally decides to use her real name, Elizabeth, when in her late 30s, she takes on the title of Director of Outreach and Communications at an energy solutions firm. Her new job is all about perfecting the appearance of things, telling the right story. If mobility is a morality tale about a person who chooses blindness over sight, what lesson should we take from it? What kind of future awaits us if we, like Bunny, choose to live in ignorance and then spin into a good story all that we can't control? Widespread destruction, for one thing. Bunny maintains her faith that there is nothing still that a neat narrative can't fix. Her mother always hated this house anyway, she thinks. They would have to see this as a blessing when she eventually migrates to Portland, Oregon, where, if you had money, the charming old houses could be retrofitted tastefully to withstand longer smoky seasons, wetter winters, hotter summers. Laid off before she has her only child, Bunny begins to applying her fluency to securing the house, thinking about their individual energy future, her gaze firmly evaded from the hyper-object. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print-impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.